Welcome to Breast Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For more than 30 years, Dr. Mark Lipman has had an important leadership role in translational oncology, and I met with Dr. Lipman to get his take on where we are and where we're headed in molecular targeted therapy of breast cancer. Dr. Lipman began our conversation by commenting on what he sees as the optimal approach to an overall research strategy.
One of the things that is most going to transform breast cancer treatment in the next few years is going to be increasingly therapies that are based on the mechanisms of what actually causes the disease, rather than simply using toxic agents that kill cells with some therapeutic index that is particularly targeted to cancer cells. We already are actually seeing targeted therapy. The very first targeted therapy is endocrine therapy. The very notion of measuring the estrogen receptor clearly is based on the notion that that is a protein with which estrogens interact, and if that protein isn't there, tumors won't respond to endocrine therapy. So if we just simply imagine expanding that to look at other targets for what makes breast cancer grow or metastasize or develop a blood supply, we can readily understand how there will be the potential for developing these new kinds of targeted therapies. One of the ones that I think is particularly exciting, not only because there's already some evidence that it's working, but also because it has the potential to apply to so many other cancers aside from just breast cancer, are therapies that target apoptosis. Let me just explain for a second what apoptosis is. Apoptosis, which is also known as programmed cell death, is a commitment that a cell makes literally to kill itself. And this is a good thing. A normal cell, when it is damaged, has two options available to it. It can pause and not grow while it tries to repair itself, or it can sense by internal mechanisms that it has been so damaged that the best thing it can do for the organism is to kill itself. And a very trivial but very useful analogy is when you sit out in the sun and you get too much of an erythema or a sunburn, if those cells can't repair themselves, they kill themselves and your nose peels. That's a good thing because things like UV irradiation causes DNA damage, and we're aware that 100% of all cancer is caused by DNA damage. So the possibility of a cell having DNA damage and not killing itself is an easy route to creating cancer. Therefore, we're not surprised that one of the early steps that cancers develop as part of their ability to evade killing themselves when they are damaged, their DNA is harmed, is to learn how to defeat apoptosis. A lot of studies done in many groups have shown that there are specific molecules that normally help a cell avoid prematurely undergoing apoptosis. These are the body's normal defenses against undergoing apoptosis. Cancer cells strengthen these defenses. They strengthen them by overexpressing or amplifying the genes and the proteins derived from those genes, which encode proteins which block apoptosis. Therefore, a variety of groups, including our own, have been exploring ways of keeping these proteins, which prevent cells from undergoing apoptosis, from being effective. There are a lot of ways one can imagine doing this. There are strategies now that have been shown to be successful in experimental animals in which you can block the messenger RNA, which encodes a specific protein. The first way that this has been done is with so-called antisense RNA, and there are companies out there which are developing antisense strategies which interact with certain RNAs which encode proteins that one wishes to block. If we remember that each protein has its own specific messenger RNA, and each specific messenger RNA has its nucleotide, nucleic acid code, then we can understand that there is a complementary code which will base pair, just like both halves of the zipper in your pants, and block this messenger RNA from working and cause its degradation. So this strategy has been successful in animals and is in clinical trials. An even more exciting strategy these days is something called silencing RNAs, or siRNAs. siRNAs are RNAs that very specifically target only one nucleic acid sequence and thus are, in theory, absolutely specific for a specific targeted RNA. Recently, it's just been reported that these siRNAs can block messenger RNAs in experimental animals, And I suspect there will be clinical trials using these siRNAs in the next year or two in human beings. Once again, the huge theoretical advantage of both of these approaches is that because each messenger RNA for a specific protein has an exact nucleic acid code, an siRNA will, in theory, only target the one specific molecule of interest. And hopefully, that might avoid a great deal of toxicity. In our own group, we have been using small molecules to block the target proteins to which these anti-apoptotic proteins bind. As I mentioned, cancer cells amplify or expand the proteins which block apoptosis. We have been able, as have other groups, to develop small molecules which keep these anti-apoptotic molecules from working because we keep them from blocking to their targets. What would this mean clinically? Imagine that you are carefully balanced on both feet and I push you on your shoulders. It's likely that I won't be able to push you over onto the ground. But if I make you hop on one foot and push you over, you're much less steady. In that same sense, these molecules which block apoptosis keep a cancer steady on its feet and able to withstand radiation and chemotherapy. When we predispose these cancer cells to apoptosis and we come along with a standard therapy, radiation or drugs, we would anticipate that we would sensitize these tumors to these anti-cancer therapies. And at least in model systems, this appears to work.
What do we know about the effect of our two current targeted therapies, endocrine treatment and trastuzumab, in terms of apoptosis?
Both of those therapies increase the apoptosis in cancer cells, so that anything that comes along and makes it easier for the cells to undergo apoptosis, we would imagine complement the effectiveness of trastuzumab or other endocrine treatments. And in fact, there is excellent evidence in model systems that that's exactly the case. And I suspect we'll be seeing clinical trials that look exactly like that over the next year or two.
I had actually interviewed Jenny Chang, who did some fascinating work on neoadjuvant trastuzumab, showing that apoptosis was a big part of the anti-tumor effect. Overall, what do we know about how trastuzumab works?
Well, that's a very good question. There are actually some conflicting data on the mechanisms of action of trastuzumab. One thing that seems fairly certain is that trastuzumab interferes with the signaling of the EGF receptor family growth factor receptors on the cell surface. Trastuzumab, recall, is an antibody to HER2, HER2 or NEU-NU. By interfering with that receptor, it blocks signaling, intracellular signaling of that receptor, which is in effect a growth factor signal to the cell. And therefore, the cell is unable to continue its normal proliferative process and commonly undergoes apoptotic cell death. The therapies that we've just been talking about the last couple of minutes would make the cell more sensitive to that killing because the cell would be predisposed to undergo apoptosis since one of its defenses against apoptosis would have been removed.
You mentioned the antisense strategy. What do we know right now about that and what's been seen so far in clinical trials?
The most important antisense trial that we would be talking about is an antisense directed against a messenger RNA for the protein BCL2. BCL2 is one of these proteins that keeps a cell from undergoing apoptosis. BCL2 is a protein which inhibits apoptosis, and BCL2 is overexpressed in many cancers. It's overexpressed in some breast cancers. It's overexpressed in lymphoma. There are plenty of data showing that if you knock out BCL2 with any of several different strategies, cells will either die or be very sensitive to chemotherapy. A specific company, a biotechnology company called Genta, has been doing clinical trials on a BCL2 antisense. Their molecule is called Genesense, and they have reported, I have no inside information on this, but at various meetings they have reported significant preclinical activity as well as some activity, particularly in CLL, and I believe some activity in malignant melanoma as well. Both of those tumors commonly overexpress BCL2, and if activity is sufficient and toxicity, which has not been a critical factor thus far, remains at a low level, this may be an interesting new potential therapy. What I think is important, even more importantly, is that this is a potential proof of principle that going after these molecules that help a cell defend against apoptosis is an important strategy.
Are there any markers or ways to identify tumors where you might expect a greater impact from anti-apoptotic therapy?
So that's a wonderful question. One of the ways in which cancers resist apoptosis is by overexpressing proteins which block apoptosis. There are several different proteins in this family, and knowing which one was overexpressed would be very important. For example, a BCL2 antisense molecule would not work in a tumor which was resistant to apoptosis because it overexpressed BCLXL or BCLW because the molecules are specific for their targets. So what you're getting at is it would be extremely important to do the kind of experiment in which you measure in tumors the specific anti-apoptotic molecules that the tumor is expressing. We're seeing that increasingly. The work that you cited by Jenny Chang at the Baylor Breast Center is one very important example in which people pre-clinical treatment are measuring the patterns of gene expression in tumors and using those patterns to predict response to specific therapies.
That kind of leads into the whole topic of predictors of response to targeted therapy, and particularly the new generation of clinical trials, NSABP 40 and 41, designed to identify markers of tumor response. What are your thoughts about those strategies?
I think those trials are extremely important, and I'm happy to make the very firm prediction that they absolutely will succeed. And the reason for that is as follows. When we use drugs in breast cancer, we know that sometimes they work, and we know that sometimes they don't work. There are only two general reasons why the drugs don't work. One reason is sort of a classical pharmacologic kind of reason. Either the drugs don't get there, we don't deliver sufficient dose, they don't penetrate the tumor, or there are metabolizing enzymes that inactivate them. Those are all possible. And the second obvious reason is that the tumor doesn't care. The tumor is resistant. The tumor doesn't use a pathway for which the drug is effective. Obviously, that is not going to be created out of magic. If we measure the pathways that a tumor is exploiting, particularly by simply casting a very wide net, by measuring all of the genes that a tumor is expressing, it seems to me, in effect, impossible that patterns will not emerge that tell you which kinds of tumors will respond to a given drug and which will not.
Specifically in terms of predicting a response to chemotherapy, I can think back 20 to 30 years of people trying to replicate the sort of culture and sensitivity approach to anti-cancer therapy. And I understand there's some new assays looking at this and that the NSABP might actually incorporate it into their trials. Can you talk a little bit about this research strategy?
Right. So there are several strategies which seem intuitively very likely to work, but which have been difficult. Just as you can grow the bacteria in a urinary tract infection and predict by using various discs loaded with various antibiotics which antibiotics will work or not and do a culture insensitivity, many groups thought it would be trivially easy to look at tumors and simply expose them to various concentrations of drugs in vitro, and by that means predict responsivity. These have been partial successes. In general, they are pretty good at predicting resistance. When you cook up these tumor samples with various concentrations of drugs, if you don't see a response, the likelihood that the patient will respond is negligible. So that the prediction of resistance is good. The prediction of sensitivity has been much more difficult, and I think that in part reflects the fact that it's very difficult to cook up or incubate cancer cells in vitro in a way that's physiologically relevant to how those cancer cells are actually exposed to a drug in vivo. In other words, the times, the doses, and all of that makes it somewhat difficult. That's entirely different from the kind of strategy that Soon Paik spoke about that the NSABP is using. The NSABP is collaborating with a company called Genomic Health, and in those assays, they are actually measuring the concentrations of the messenger RNA for about 21 different molecules. None of them are the direct targets of tamoxifen or of any drugs, but they have developed a discriminant just by doing the experiment over and over again that suggests that the concentrations of these various messenger RNAs accurately predict risk of relapse in response to tamoxifen. That's not something that was intuitively obvious, but simply turned out to be empirically true. What I am saying is almost exactly the same thing. If you start off and say, what is a cancer? One way to define a cancer is to say it is the product of all of its messenger RNAs and therefore the proteins that are made as a result of those messenger RNAs. I am further hypothesizing that it is those messenger RNAs and the proteins encoded by them which are responsible for whether or not a specific tumor will respond to doxorubicin or Cytoxan or not. If you simply do the experiment in which you take, for example, 100 breast cancers in human beings, take their RNA and look at the patterns of expression of every gene in that breast cancer, and then say, post facto, half of these patients responded to Adriamycin and half did not. Is there some difference in the pattern of expression of RNA between the responders and not that I can bank on, that I can begin to identify? The answer is emerging very rapidly that the answer is yes, that you can do that. You can develop predictive tests that will tell you which patients will respond to individual drugs. What I think is very exciting about that is I find it very difficult to imagine why those tests will not be generalizable across tumor types. One of my personal views is that we will increasingly, in the years to come, stop talking about cancers based on the tissue of origin and far more increasingly begin to talk about them based upon the specific pathways that they are exploiting.
Of course, there's been a lot of fascinating recent work that's been done on breast cancer classification, Charles Perreault, et cetera. Can you talk about how you currently conceptualize breast cancer?
So just to make sure that all of the people understand what we're talking about, Charles Perreault and his collaborators at Stanford took a large number of breast cancers and without any predestined hypotheses, simply measured expression of every RNA in those tumors and asked, did those breast cancers emerge into different patterns? Just as you might open up a bag of M&Ms and sort them by color, you'd have five or six different piles of colors, whatever they come in, red, yellow, green, blue, brown. And so you'd say there are five kinds of M&Ms. And you'd be using a single discriminant, color, to tell those kinds of M&Ms apart. Now imagine instead of looking at just color, you looked at 20,000 characteristics of each M&M. You might say you might get thousands of piles, but you didn't. In fact, what Perreault found was that breast cancer was sorted into about six piles, almost like the M&Ms, actually. And those have been given names, which may or may not be completely perfect in terms of describing them, luminal A, luminal B, basal type, HER2-NU breast cancers. But it's clear that each of those patterns described a different biology in terms of natural history or prognosis. In some cases, pretty reliably defined responsivity to trastuzumab without actually even measuring HER2-NU. In other words, the thing that's important here is that looking at the whole pattern of genes expressed, you can tell more than by just identifying the single target. So I think there's now been a plethora of studies reclassifying many different kinds of tumors, not just breast cancer. And those studies, I think, are all of them extremely exciting. For listeners who are interested, I suggest that they go to a website called OncoMine, OncoMine.org, which is based here at the University of Michigan and is a summation of all of these studies looking at expression patterns in different cancers. And I think this is one of the most exciting things to come along in many years.
You mentioned Soon Paik's work with the NSABP and the Oncotype DX assay, and I'm curious about your take on that, specifically of whether or not this is just a more accurate ER and HER2 assay. What do you think the message is that's coming out of these data?
That's a wonderful question. And I think that the skeptic group says, what do I learn from this analysis that I would not learn by looking at a couple of obvious things like ER and the histologic grade and things that are readily available? And how much additional information is hidden, as it were, in this molecular analysis that I would not otherwise get at? I think that that has not been formally evaluated. It's kind of an interesting question. Would you get five wise clinicians in a room and put them up just like you used to play chess against the IBM computer, Deep Blue, and see who did better? That'd be a fun exercise. But I think already many clinicians, myself included, feel that for those patients who are obviously in the good or bad acting group, this test adds very little. But there is a group of people who clearly, it's not intuitively obvious how they're going to do. And some of those patients have unusually high or low scores. And I believe that there is already sufficient information to say that in that setting that this could be a reliable test. Right now in the United States, certainly we are over-treating node-negative breast cancer with chemotherapy. The NCI consensus guidelines suggest that somewhere between 85 and 90% of all node-negative patients should receive chemotherapy. The St. Gallen guidelines are more like 75%. Yet we know that only about 30% of node-negative patients will ever recur. So by definition, we're giving a lot of chemotherapy to people who don't need it. And obviously, I think it would be very useful in terms of avoiding a variety of toxicities and other things if we were a bit better at that. I want to say that while Genomic Health and the NSABP have collaborated and done a great deal to come up with these discriminants, there are at least three or four other publications showing other kinds of discriminants that perform, it seems, equally as well. And I think that this is an early field, and I think we need to allow these various discriminants to mature a bit to discover what we think is the best and the most clinically useful. But that is not in any sense to argue that looking at the entire array of what a tumor can do will not provide more information about the behavior, just as if you look at a child and notice that their nose is pierced, that doesn't tell you very much about their behavior, although it has some predictive value.
One part of this discussion has been the issue of response to chemotherapy in patients based on estrogen receptor status, something that you published on quite a while back. What are your thoughts on this at the moment, and what do you think is going on that there is a correlation between estrogen receptor status and response to chemotherapy?
My goodness, you're making me feel like an antique. It's true, we published in the New England Journal, I believe in 76, that patients who were ER negative responded more commonly to chemotherapy. And in fact, those data have been replicated in the meta-analyses that have been done in England by Pito and his many, many collaborators. I think that the clue to why that works is obtained if you look at recurrence rates for women with breast cancer as a function of whether they are ER positive or ER negative. It is commonly said, but that doesn't necessarily make it the truth, that being ER positive is a good prognostic factor. But if you look at the data, and this has now been shown several times over, it is true that early on, if you're ER positive, your relapse rates are lower. But over time, the ER negative patients who relapse at a higher rate initially stop relapsing, perhaps because most of the ones with bad prognoses have already died, whereas the ER positive ones continue to relapse, and those lines actually cross. So that at about 10 or 12 or 15 years, you're worse off being ER positive than being ER negative. What does that mean? Biologically, what that probably means is that ER positive breast cancers are growing more slowly. And therefore, the whole story in terms of why did chemotherapy work a little bit better is probably based on the fact that ER negative tumors have a little bit higher cycling rate or a little bit faster growing, and a wealth of data suggests they're a little more sensitive to chemotherapy. And I think that's the whole story.
I guess as long as we're talking about work from your past, I wanted to ask you about the concept of estrogen priming of breast cancer to make it more sensitive to chemotherapy, something that you reported on quite a while back. Whatever happened with that strategy, and do you think it still has any potential?
Well, lots of research tends to be in vogue and then not in vogue, and it's not always clear why that is. We did a small randomized study at the NCI some years ago, and that was borderline statistically positive, suggesting that some sequencing might help with the strategy we chose to use. The EORTC did a larger randomized trial, once again in the late 70s, testing this, and that study was dead negative, and it died out. A similar approach was tried briefly in prostate cancer, but of course there was no effective chemotherapy for prostate at the time. I think that there's nothing wrong with the hypothesis that altering the kinetics of a tumor temporarily might alter its response rate to chemotherapy, but I don't think that there's ever been a sufficient amount of actual measurement of individual tumors to know how to do it, and we were just flying by the seat of our pants. We gave a few days of Premarin as though we knew what we were doing, and I really can't say that I would do a study like that unless I had the means, presumably, I guess, with some sort of molecular imaging so that you didn't have to keep biopsying, some way that you could actually see that you were catching the tumor at the right moment.
Is there any molecular imaging right now that you think does have that potential?
Yes, there is. There are certainly studies involving ATP energy levels that can be used as a surrogate for growth. I'm not trying to suggest these are available routinely, but this could be done in a laboratory setting or a clinical trial setting to at least try to develop an appropriate means of developing a clinical trial. But I think that most people aren't that excited about this right now. I think most people are hoping that one of these other molecular targets, which appears potentially to be underpinning breast cancer, angiogenic targets, these apoptotic targets, certainly the tyrosine kinase targets.
Continuing on the same lines of molecular targeted therapy, I'm curious what your take was on Dennis Slamon's presentation at San Antonio on the BCRG-006 trial, and specifically the data he presented on Topo II.
I think that's very exciting data, and I hope it is substantiated. It makes biological plausibility. Topo II is a target of doxorubicin. The fact that that would potentially explain which subset of patients were particularly advantaged by using the doxorubicin combinations as compared to the platinum combinations is, as I said, biologically plausible, and I think makes sense. There are some wonderful data that were developed by Adrian Harris, looking at those patients who overexpressed topotecan, showing that they were the group of patients, even with breast cancer, who responded to epipodophyllotoxin, which specifically targets Topo II. So I think those data are very interesting. I'm not ready to draw the conclusion that Professor Slamon appeared to wish to draw, which is that in those patients who did not overexpress Topo II, the use of non-doxorubicin-containing combinations was as efficacious. That may be true, but I'm not there yet. I think we need more analysis. But I think it would be wonderful, given the potential additional risks of using trastuzumab with doxorubicin in terms of cardiac risk, particularly in older women, it would be nice to have a less cardiotoxic regimen to employ. In that same regard, I found the data that Soon Paik has presented from the NSABP on MYC, M-Y-C, overexpression, extremely exciting and once again very biologically plausible.
Can you explain what c-MYC is?
MYC, M-Y-C, is an oncogene. It is upregulated commonly when cells are stimulated to grow. It is part of the growth response. And when MYC is overexpressed in tumors, it is transforming, can induce cells to cause cancer. MYC has been much more difficult to measure than other oncogenes. The protein is short-lived, the antibody studies aren't so good, but MYC is clearly overexpressed in about 20 to about 25% of human breast cancers. Robert Dixon at the Lombardi Cancer Center did a lovely meta-analysis on that a few years ago, and those were the numbers which he found. What's always been paradoxical to many people is why it is that many patients whose tumors unquestionably overexpress the target of Herceptin, overexpress HER2-NU, do not in fact respond to Herceptin. Even in the best done single agent previously untreated patients, the response rates are only about 35% or so. So that raises the exact same question that we brought up before. Do some patients fail to respond to Herceptin because it doesn't get there, it doesn't reach the target, there's a pharmacologic explanation, or is there something else that's required, aside from simply the overexpression of the target for trastuzumab to work? And what Soon's data showed rather conclusively, it was only those patients who co-expressed MYC, this oncogene, and HER2-NU, in which the response to Herceptin was seen. And once again, those data need replication badly, but should that be the case, that would be tremendously insightful.
You mentioned an anti-angiogenic strategy, and it's been fun for us as a CME group to sort of track the bevacizumab story, starting with colon, then lung, and breast cancer. Along the way, my favorite question has been, why do you think it works? How do you think bevacizumab works?
Bevacizumab is an antibody against an angiogenic molecule called VEGF, and it certainly makes biological sense to me that if there were less VEGF available to stimulate angiogenic growth, there would be less angiogenesis. Most human cancers live on the very edge of their blood supplies. Most cancers don't have enough blood supply. In you and I, we have redundant blood supplies. If you squeeze your radial artery, your hand won't turn blue and fall off because most people have an adequate ulnar artery so that we have redundant collateral vessels. Most tumors are not put together that way. Most tumors, as you know, are anoxic, using anaerobic glycolysis, and have extremely low oxygen tensions. Therefore, that implies that even a bit more strangulation, even a bit more interference with vasculature might have a worthwhile clinical effect. So I think it's entirely reasonable that an agent like bevacizumab might work. I think that if you recall the statements that I made about apoptosis, that cancers are predisposed to undergo apoptosis and have to figure out ways to defend themselves, it seems clear to me that if you used a drug that has some effectiveness against a cancer cell and further compromised its blood supply at the same time, that could be a very winning strategy. And I think the proof is clearly in the pudding. A whole host of studies of bevacizumab have been really quite positive, and I think we're all awaiting with extreme interest the results of such studies in the adjuvant setting.
Another mechanism a lot of people have talked about is normalization of the blood supply, actually to facilitate delivery of chemotherapy to the tumor.
Well, there have been a whole host of potential ways of simply trying to get a bit more drug to the tumor, arguing that if you could even increase the therapeutic index a tiny bit, you might get there. Some of them are extremely imaginative and almost like Jules Verne. One that I've seen that actually has very positive preclinical studies is literally putting little iron filings on doxorubicin and then holding a magnet over the liver to treat hepatocellular carcinoma, just using the magnetized drug to localize there. There are half of a dozen, if not more, small particle type, nanoparticle liposome type approaches, which take advantage of the fact that the blood supply in tumors is not through normal capillary beds and that these liposomes will entrap and have longer periods of release of drug in tumor beds. And that's turned out to be a potentially effective treatment strategy. There are also several very interesting approaches that take advantage of the fact that tumors are anoxic and do require, live almost exclusively on glucose. One company is making or using compounds that are linked to sugar and taking advantage of the fact that tumors, because of their avidity for glucose, may take these up at an enhanced rate. That's the entire principle of the PET scan, which, as you recall, is fluorodeoxyglucose. And even in the brain, which is a pure glucose obligate, the brain lives on sugar. Even so, you can image gliomas and metastases in the brain because tumors use sugar even more avidly than brain.
In terms of molecular therapy, it's been interesting to follow the tyrosine kinase story in lung cancer with the EGFR mutations and the smoking and other phenotypic correlations of response to TKIs. Also, the story in primary breast cancer with EGF receptor mutations. What are your thoughts about these issues, and do you think they're relevant to breast cancer?
Well, first of all, that is absolutely correct that in gliomas, mutations in the EGF receptor have been described. And furthermore, not only are these mutations in the receptor interesting, but they are pathogenic. These are fully activated receptors that do not require growth factor to bind to them. So the presence of this mutated receptor is a sufficient engine to drive the glioblastoma. So not only is it a unique target, but it's a molecularly important target. The reason why I find that particularly fascinating is because it's a mutation. In theory, it would be perfectly targetable either by an antibody or an antisense or an siRNA because it would be targeting something that absolutely does not exist in any other normal tissue. So you would have a dream come true, the perfect cancer target, because if you hit it perfectly, you would not be hitting any normal tissue whatsoever. As to why it appears to have some differential expression in lung cancer in smokers versus non-smokers, I haven't a clue.
Do you think that the same type of research would yield benefits in breast cancer?
I think that people have looked for these kinase mutants in breast cancer and have basically not found them. There were originally some reports that they were there, but more detailed studies have subsequently suggested that may not be the case, which touches on one of the great curiosities of cancer. We don't understand why certain mutations cause cancer in some tissues and not in others. We don't understand, for example, why mismatch repair genes, which ought to predispose you to cancer in every organ in your body, tend to only cause colon cancer. Why don't they cause breast cancer? There's some mysteries out there to be unraveled.
The last thing I want to ask you about is sort of your overall perspective in terms of clinical research, laboratory research in breast cancer, and the overall direction that we're heading and how we're investing our resources in trying to solve this problem.
That's another terrific question. I don't think anybody, and certainly I don't consider myself to have the sort of magical vision to know which is the exact perfect line of investigation to pursue. It's thrilling and exciting to go to cancer meetings these days and to see such a broad array of exciting activities, any one of which one could imagine having a specific transformative event on the disease. I think that's really exciting, whether or not you've spent your life doing angiogenesis or apoptosis or DNA repair or drug delivery. There's enough excitement and enough good work going on to imagine any of those approaches succeeding. I think some of the issues here are less intellectual in terms of barriers than they are political and economic. I think we are still a disaster as a nation and as a world in putting patients on study. I think it's extraordinarily unfortunate that so few patients, even to this date, participate in trials. I am deeply concerned about the substantial reduction in the federal budgets. Despite the major funding spent by pharmaceutical companies, I think the major intellectual engine that drives cancer research is still academic in origin and then licensed or in other ways developed by pharmaceutical industry. And I think that we're playing with fire right now to look at a flat or decreasing NIH budget. And I think that has ramifications not only in terms of actual investigations, but the extraordinary, every day I see it as chairman of medicine, in terms of decreased enthusiasm for an academic life. People don't want a life with the level of uncertainty in terms of survival that appears to be going on. And I'm afraid we will lose a generation of the kinds of translational and clinical investigators that will be essential to driving this process forward. That would be a disgrace.
A lot of the clinical research that's actually changed practice in the last 5 or 10 years came out of the private sector. And along with that, there have been a lot of concerns about costs, particularly biologics such as bevacizumab. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think that is a special and extremely important case of a widespread healthcare catastrophe which we are facing. We have 40 plus million Americans who have no health insurance. That number is likely to grow with the economic tribulations that may well be part of this country's economy in the near future. There are any number of countries which are strongly considering rationing of these very expensive therapies or even not making them available. It's a very difficult question in which you say, is it worth $100,000 a year for society to buy an average of 4 months of survival for someone? Knowing, in fact, that it's not 4 months for everyone, but a year or two for some people and nothing for a lot of other people, because that's how response rates are distributed. This is a tremendous issue. I think it's going to get worse because many of these therapies are expensive to develop, and many of them are, even when developed, expensive to manufacture. Antibody therapies have a tremendous cost of goods that may not be the same as a small molecule kinase inhibitor. But when you ferment human cells in vats, you can't make these recombinant proteins very inexpensively, though you can certainly make them for a lot less than they're currently being sold for. And I think we're going to have some kind of national debate on this as we see pharmacology playing a greater and greater role in patient care. A way that I've noticed it over the last 20 or 25 years in the part of my life that I spend as a general internist is that in the old days, patients were on 2 or 3 drugs. Now, the kinds of patients who I see admitted to the hospital who are in their 60s and 70s are rarely on less than 10. And this kind of polypharmacy not only creates a nightmare in terms of drug interactions and avoiding toxicities and unforeseen problems, but creates a gigantic societal expense. One can hope that this will be improved somewhat by paying for the kind of studies that allow you to know who will benefit.
Specifically, as it relates to bevacizumab, are there any markers that you think perhaps in the future might prove to predict response to that agent?
I would be speculating here without strong knowledge, but certainly we know that many cancers have other angiogenic molecules other than VEGF. So that if a tumor is making pleiotropin or making FGF2 or some other molecule responsible for its tumorigenesis, clearly bevacizumab won't work. That's perhaps one of the reasons why in more advanced patients, bevacizumab seems less effective than when used early. So that it may well be that looking at the array of angiogenic molecules that a given tumor is making may, and I emphasize may help to predict which patients will respond to bevacizumab. It's even possible that serum studies looking at the levels of these various angiogenic molecules in tumor patients may be of some value.